Okay, may I begin?
Sure.
Okay, hi everybody, welcome to the Low Power FM All Day Intensive. This is to help you take in the fruits of the experiences of 8 presenters. These are the best in the biz, guys. So I'd like to introduce them at this, logistics. So now does everyone have a copy, paper copy of the agenda? We'll tell you what we're going to talk about during each session. Okay, they're coming.
More? Okay.
And this is also it.
These are the big guys.
And that way, it's something that you don't really need to come here for. You don't need to. But this agenda has everything. Let's say you know nothing. It has everything you need. Okay? And if you have any logistical kinds of questions, come to me, Betty McCardle from Community Media Assistance Project. I'm the wrangler today, okay? Now I'd like to introduce our presenters, and as they do a presentation, they will more fully introduce themselves, okay? So I'm going to start with Mickey Bradley, who's going to be doing the first session.
To hear what everybody's
thought. I thought of that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Any other questions?
Anybody else still need an agenda?
Oh,
yeah.
Please.
From Sonora, California. We have a CP and we're just getting launched.
Marika Partridge from the outskirts of Washington, D.C. We're in an MX with 5 other groups. 3 of us are pretty serious and we're waiting for the FCC to get to our area.
Would you share what the name of your organization is?
Oh, sorry, Tacoma Radio. Tacoma Radio in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
What was your
KAAD?
The name of your group?
Oh, Tuolumne County Arts Alliance.
I'm Jace Barnabas from Rochester, New York, Rochester Community TV, and Hibero. We're trying to work out our differences, whatever, to share signal or what we got to
share.
John Morgan, Ohio Valley Peace, based in Wheeling, West Virginia, and we're in an MX of one other party. Mm.
Danny Dan Hazard, Syracuse Community of Syracuse, New York, for MX with another party.
Malachi Muncie, Fort Hood, Killeen, Under the Hood Cafe, we have a CP.
Cool.
Yeah.
My name is Mark Allen Derry. We have a CP, the 102.3 WHIV program dedicated to human rights and social justice. We hopefully will be going on Saturday, November 1st, which is World AIDS Day.
Where are you?
New Orleans, I'm sorry, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, cool.
Hi, I'm Preston Pope, and I'm here with Firehouse Cultural Center, WPHX, the Phoenix in Ruskin, Florida. We have our CP, and we have our CP.
That is such a good thing. Let's do the white table.
Sure. My name is Mike Yates. I'm also from Rochester, New York. Thanks to a lot of the people sitting behind me, we have a CP, and... We are WAYO, and we have a studio space broadcast tower. We're about to start fundraising on Wednesday, and we're targeting a launch of late 2014. What's the name of the group? Our station is WAYO. We're affiliated with the multi-use community cultural center in Blackwater.
We're all from Lexington Community Radio. There are five of us at the conference. We have two applications in. One has received a CP, so that is WLXL, Living Extra Large, or Lexington Local, or Lexington Latino, whatever. And so we are building that to October 2015. The other one is an MX with one other party. We have two applications in and possible for approval because we are designated as a public safety station. So we have public safety programming.
That's Kathy, that's Ilya, and I'm Mitch.
Oh, hi, yeah.
Hi, yeah. Lori Anderson, I'm KOTC Houston. I'm here for a learning experience. I'm already with the station.
Elizabeth Robinson from KTSB, but also working with two low-power groups who have their CPs. One may be KRZALP, we're not sure we have that, those call letters, but it's for the La Casa de Maraza in Santa Barbara, and the second one is in Oxnard, California, a Huisteco indigena group, and they're doing radio deco, but they don't have call letters.
Oh, your friend?
No, I'm just
trying to
say.
Oh, okay.
Come on, you can come.
I got a seat
for
you here.
All the Rochester people should sit together.
Yeah.
We got rear four groups from Rochester?
Okay.
Sorry.
Hi, I'm Sharon Scott. I'm with Art FM in Louisville, Kentucky. Sean Selby is with us as well. We're an online radio station. We've been online for over a year now. Have our application in for Local RFM, and we're in an MX.
I'm also going to
get back.
Hi, Lisa Wolf from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. We are Sun Prairie Community Media, 135 The Sun. Our CP has been granted. This is Jill Golden, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Ground Zero Radio, KGZR. Our CP has been granted, and they put the cart before the horse, so we're trying to fundraise like crazy.
Moose's Wana, WCAA-LP 107.1, Albany, New York. We're granted our CP, and we're trying to figure out the rest.
Eric Cowan, Madison, Wisconsin, with WIDE, and also helping out some other. Madison has, four construction permits.
I'm Keith from KXDJ LP, way out in the Twigs in Oregon, and
Cave Junction,
Oregon. Sparta Living Center is our NGO, and there's no worries about MX groups for
no worries, not in our area either. Two Harvest, Minnesota, and Two Harvest Community Radio, and there were seven
frequencies available in our area. We were the only app, so we are GP, and we're going to be fundraising time here.
I'm Reverend Joan Ross from North Edward Community Coalition. I hail out of Detroit, Michigan, 96.7. We hope WNUC to go up. We got our CP, and we hope to hopefully launch in November. And I just thank God for Mike Brown.
This station defied everything. We were all going to say that Detroit was not going to get LPFM. We all said it. I said it. Many people said it. They did it. Woo!
I'm
CP 3 to 4 weeks before.
Wow.
Yeah.
What?
3 to 4 weeks and we'll be on air.
Oh, right.
I'm Michael Sharpstein. I'm one of the sponsors. I'm with SEMS. We're a broadcast equipment distributor. We've been in business for 38 years, a family-owned business out of North Carolina. We have packages set up. We started about a year before all the CPs were granted, coming up with different packages to try to fit everybody's budget. We have financing. We have creative ways that we can help you with fundraising. So we're here to help. We have 256 manufacturers that we represent. So we feel like there's a broad range, depending on your budget, that we can help you with.
And go see him out in the...
Yeah, I have a booth, the last table on the left out there. Lots of pens, all that good stuff.
I'm Christy White, and I work with Nautel, and we're a transmitter manufacturer, so you're here with transmitters today. Just stop by, I also have a table, and just come see what I can.
Yeah, we'll be talking about a lot of equipment that we can be able to represent, so we'll see.
I'm Sean Selby, part of Louisville.
You!
Baby, I'll be working at the Air Force Vista at Zumix in Boston. Yeah. Zumix, which is a youth and community radio station in Boston. Mm-hmm. And we're also in an MX.
Where are you?
East Boston.
East Boston,
yeah.
Sam Brannon, I'm with San Marcos, Texas Radio, San Marcos, Texas. We got the construction permit, and we're learning to fly.
Okay, for those of you in the MX situation, we do have a session late this afternoon on 7. It'll be very helpful for you. Did I hit you?
I moved. My name's Maddie. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina. We're in an MX situation. And what else was that?
That's it. Okay, did I miss anybody? Okay.
One more.
I did. Oh, miss.
So I'm glad that that's a girl from Rochester, New York, and we're in
Okay, so let's get started. Our first session is getting started. Okay, rules, checklist, and costs. So the first one is the LPF rules. Top 10 rules you inadvertently might break. Oh, by the way, did everyone get a written agenda? No? 2, 3, 4, 5?
I have. Probably 5 years. Well, 4 years.
10 times this way, 10 times that.
We can print more.
Okay. Well, we get one more over here. Was there somebody over here? There, are you in the session? Okay. All right, so our presenters for this session will be Michael, Vici, and Pablito. Pablito is...
Okay, well, I've worked up a PowerPoint on this, but the other guys can come in whenever you have a comment on that. This actually overlaps a lot with the checklist. Almost all these items are on the LPFM checklist, and if you're not aware of that or haven't seen it yet, this is something you need to look at right away. If you can get through this checklist, you can almost certainly pass an FCC inspection. But we're just going to go through the top 10 rules that either are commonly misunderstood or are commonly looked at the moment an inspector walks in the door. Building according to the construction permit. You cannot change the location unless you reapply to modify your construction permit. However, since we're usually only using the nearest second, if you're building a new tower or you got it slightly wrong, you've got a half second tolerance to deal with. That would still be the same coordinates. And so,
tell them how much space that
is. Yeah, well, depending on your latitude and location of the country, it's going to be roughly 30 feet north-south and 20 feet east-west. So if you're within that, you're still rounded to the nearest point, the nearest second. The tower height cannot change from your construction permit. However, you're rounding to the nearest meter, so you can be a half meter off, which is about a foot and a half. By the way, once you have a construction permit, if you have to make some minor changes, this is not going to take years. If you're not asking for any waivers beyond a second adjacent waiver, it's routine. You'll get approved within a few weeks. If you're in a big hurry, you can ask for expedited processing, and we've gotten things approved in 48 hours on occasion.
The average right now is about 3 weeks.
Yeah. So don't be intimidated by the minor change process if you need to make a slight change in your construction permit.
Okay, and so a lot of people break this rule.
Yeah.
It is really hard. And why? Because it's hard to build something tall. There are a number of stations that went on the air in 2001, 2002 that are still 10, 15 meters below what they said because they never raised the money for a tower. Who thinks that you get in more trouble for being taller than what you said versus shorter than what you said in your permit? Who's for taller? Who's for shorter?
Who's for both?
The FCC cares much more if you are taller than what you said.
Yeah. However, if you're on a second adjacent waiver,
yeah,
they run into a problem if you're shorter because your antenna is closer to the ground and you're going against what you told the FCC, that your antenna was going to be at a certain height above ground where the radiation, where the interference was not going to hit the ground or anybody in populated area. So in the case of a second adjacent waiver, shorter is also just as bad.
Well, although it's kind of, you got to wonder what an inspector is going to be more upset about. Mm-hmm. I mean, the second adjacent waiver is a pretty new thing, whereas there's a pretty good track record of, you said you're going to be 100 feet and you're at 200 feet?
Yeah. They're not going to climb the tower and drop the tape measure, but if it's obviously wrong, get it correct. Now, your antenna height, notwithstanding this second adjacent waiver issue, in which case it could be more critical, you are allowed to go 2 meters higher or 4 meters lower than with the antenna height than your construction permit says without having to file a minor change. You should make note of this, though, in your application for station license 319. And you just say it in there and you'll be fine.
And you've got an interference waiver. There, you're cutting it close. If you drop it 4 meters, you might be interfering with people, and you might not like that.
Well, that's true. If you're going to make any change at all, you should talk to whatever consultant prepared your original application and run this by them before you build. There may also be some special operating conditions on your construction permit, so read your construction permit. I can't tell you how many times we come up, oh, I didn't read that. We've had people install a non-directional antenna on a station that was supposed to be directional. They had to scrap the antenna and start completely from scratch.
Also, too, if your LPFM station is near an AM radio tower,
yeah,
you may get that special operating condition that you cannot go on the air until you complete out the necessary studies for the tower compliance.
Yeah, a lot of stations have that. We can talk about it if you want. But now, if you have, you should look carefully if the application was prepared on your behalf. If the second adjacent waiver relied on a specific brand or model of antenna or a specific number of bays, you should either build with that exact antenna, that's the safest thing to do, or be ready to show on the 319 how the substitute antenna still meets these requirements. Transmitter certification. I wish we didn't have to do this, but here we are. LPFM transmitters must have a sticker indicating they're LPFM certified, and a lot of them don't have that. Most of your older transmitters, used ones you might pick up, are probably not going to have this certification. Going through the process yourself to certify is possible, but it's just not practical. Now, in the past, I have to say this regulation was generally just ignored. I'm hearing from the field they're not ignoring it anymore. So, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm trying to write down fast and furious. Is there any possibility that we can get access to this PowerPoint?
I haven't yet, but I'm going to post this today to the website in both the original PowerPoint form and a PDF form.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Or I can even email it to you. If you give me a card or something, I can email it to you.
To this website? To which website are you going to?
The GRC.
The GRC website. Some of the materials, most of them aren't, but some of the materials are up there.
Well, they were up there. I got dumped this morning along with everybody else. I'm going to have to go back.
Well, maybe before the day's out, let's find the exact URL where they're going to be and show it. Okay. We'll do that after lunch. Station ID. KOH. The current regulations, which have changed slightly over the years, you need to give your station legal ID and sign off, and as close as possible to the top of the hour in a natural bake of the program. There is no limit of minutes anymore. It's supposed to be just as close as possible in a natural break. If you've got a 20-minute song that goes through the top of the hour, just play the song. All low-power FM stations will have the -LP suffix, and you have to use that when you give your legal ID. You can. So a legal ID is call letters with the LP suffix, and then community license. In between the two, all you are allowed to do is add, at your discretion, the name of the licensee, the frequency, or the channel, which, of course, nobody uses. And that's all you can have in between. After you give the community of license, you can list a whole potpourri of additional communities there if you want to. So, for example, KOHILP's organization name actually is KOHIFM. That is the name of their organization now. So they can say KOHILP, KOHIFM, 89.1, Channel 206, Story City, which is their official city license, and then list Ames and Boone, the two larger cities that are nearby. So that's a legal ID. This is not a legal ID. KOHI, the heart of Iowa, community radio for Ames, some of their nicknames or whatever. Not a legal ID. You can say this 100 times an hour. The one time you have to do it right is the top of the hour. The rest of the hour, you can say whatever you want.
Quick question, Mike. As long as you do call letters and city of license, it doesn't matter if you do a frequency after, if it's actually the one for that, right?
Yeah, you can do the frequency in the middle is just totally optional, so you can do it after.
So, but it could be a different frequency that doesn't go with the first two.
Oh, to talk with the
train. Yeah, you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, stations have done that. Yeah, sure.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. I just want to make sure it's legal. Yeah.
Just get the
little-known facts on these. The actual reason for these is because back in the prehistoric age, you're required to do it every hour because there's always the possibility you could be interfering with an airport or air traffic of some sort. And so you can actually do it. I think there's a part of the rules that still says you can do it in Morse code.
But
that's the reason for this concise format is they're looking, if you're causing a problem, they want it in a timely, they can predict when it's going to happen so they can figure out who you are and where this transmission is coming from and alert you that your transmitter is causing a problem with air traffic.
There's actually several problems with this last one. First one is they didn't give the -LP there. Second one is they put community radio for Ames. No, you can't say community radio. You can't have a nickname before you give the city one. So
it's not even city license.
Yeah. Station logs. There's not much logging requirements that are required for LPFM. It's just malfunctions of vital equipment, like the transmitter's off the air or running at reduced power, tower lights aren't working, and EAS. And that's about it for LPFM that you have to log. But the EAS logs are often kept separately, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. You can have it in one master piece of paper or as a separate thing. Yeah.
Can
can you opt in or out of PAS, or is the PAS required?
I believe now LPFMs have to participate now.
What is PAS?
Emergency alert system. This is a test of the posting of licenses. You must post it at your control point, which is normally considered to be the studio, although with dial-up remote controls, it's, how do you define that? Some LPFMs don't have a main studio, so how do you define that? Some of the conundrums. Anyway, post it, but at most stations opt to put it in some kind of binder, like the pre-ring binder, instead of putting it in a frame on the wall. Either one is fine. And you probably should also have it at your transmitter side. Telephone conversations. This is something that's actually, a lot of fines are issued for violating this. You must tell the caller before they're broadcast or recorded that they're being broadcast or recorded for later broadcast. Before. Political file. This is one of the few, you do not have to have a public file for low-powered FM, but you do have to have a political file. You have to have a, this is something I just found out yesterday, you have to have a complete record of all requests for broadcast time, not just who actually might have appeared on your station.
Whether you accepted them or not.
And whether you accepted them or not, and et cetera.
Can you talk a little bit, can you talk about what the law is about that, this notion of people's time and their vision? You can say no or yes as many times to as many people as you want.
Equal time.
Maybe you can comment on this. My recollection is if you have one candidate for a certain office, you have to make time available for any other candidates for that same office.
I thought we were going to return that.
Yes. Okay. No, that's the fairness doctrine.
Yeah.
And it was actually on the books until about a year or two ago, and it was finally taken off the books. But that's separate from political candidates for office. There are, you have to have the same, if you put one of them on the air, and if the other one requests it, which they may not,
Yeah.
you need to put them on at about the same time. You can't put them on at 3 in the morning, and the other one was on.
Do you have to notify them of the other candidates, or just
No, but you have to be responsive.
Right. Also, too, as a non-commercial licensee, Section 399 of the Communications Act, you cannot endorse any political candidates.
And is it also true that you still can't take any paid political announcements? You have to run them as you go.
That went back and forth in the courts, and my understanding of the latest is that it's back again. You can't take money, but for a while you could. Like 1 year. I'm not a lawyer here, so I wish
your,
I was a
your
lawyer.
Best bet is to just completely avoid it altogether.
Yeah.
Do yourself a favor, save the headache, avoid it completely. If somebody approaches you, kindly decline, log it, and be done with it.
Yeah, that also applies to politically partisan issues, not just candidates. No?
That you have to allow people to, I don't recall that.
No?
I think it's just candidates.
Just candidates for office.
Yeah.
That was fairness doctrine, and that's gone.
Okay.
And, that's been gone since Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh was allowed to emerge as a result of the end of the fairness doctrine, because, you couldn't do a conservative talk radio station and have it be conservative all the time. You would have had to have equal time for the anti-Rush Limbaugh. And we all know that didn't happen. That doesn't happen anymore since the 80s.
Underwriting announcements. I'm sure you've heard a lot about this, and most of you know what to do. There are volumes of information written on this. You just Google it, and you'll see a lot of information. But essentially, an underwriting announcement cannot have a call to action, no inducement to buy, no prices, no comparisons. However, you can promote your own event and violate all these. If it's your own event, if it's another nonprofit, or can you?
I think you can call to action as long as it's not another commercial enterprise. So if it's a nonprofit or go to the capital,
you can promote other people's. There was some discussion on that, but I don't know the latest.
Yeah.
There's a huge amount of information that's been published.
And the lawyers did provide some.
Yeah. And NFCB's Public Radio Legal Handbook actually is a good resource, too. You can get access to it for a fee, even whether or not you're a member. So.
And the thing to remember about the underwriting rules is that the reason they're confusing is because people are constantly trying to push the envelope mm-hmm. on what you can get away with. Mm-hmm. And so the way that people thought about them 20 years ago, you listen to an NPR station, and it sounds very, very different. You hear, like, the theme song of the company woven into the music surrounding
yeah,
it.
Yeah, GE, we bring good things
yeah.
to life.
Yeah, yeah, like, right, the whole thing is considered music. Like that.
Without the lyrics, yeah.
Yeah. So, the reason it's confusing is if you're trying to reinterpret the rules and wordsmith, then it's not all that hard to comply if you're not doing that. And I mean, there is a reason that there's a difference, right? Commercial radio stations, they bought their license for millions and millions of dollars. You did not buy your license for millions and millions of dollars. Part of what they get for those millions of dollars is the right to persuade people in incredibly persuasive, repetitive, annoying way that helps, you know, convince people to buy. So
some of the biggest LPFM fines that have been levied so far in the past 14 years have been on this.
Yep.
And this only applies to paid underwriting. It doesn't apply to if you have a guest from a local business or something like that. And they're not paying and we're not getting any direct kickback?
That's a good question.
We found when I was with KRZA, not LP, KRZA almost as house, we found if they want to do a call to action, if they're saying come to our blah, 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 blah. The DJs, no one can do that. No, they cannot say this is only going to cost $20. And I was really particular about that because I heard DJs doing this over and over again, and it's like, you're going to get us. And we weren't even an LP, this is just community radio. So I think it applies the same in an LPFM.
Yes.
It's the same rule to the final full power, not the same rules.
The only rules that are different are the public files and certain technical rules are more permissive for LPFM, but all the underwriting rules. And most of the other rules are the same. There's actually a section in the FCC rules that refers to which full power rules apply to LPFM. That would be good reading. By the way, it's 73.800s are where the LPFM are where all the LPFM rules are. The very first one is that list.
Yeah.
Tower fencing, marking, and lighting. Another favorite thing for inspectors to look at and fine you for. Your antenna has to be inaccessible to the public. Well, what does that mean? What that means is that for a normal adult human being, they can't get to your antenna and, you know, irradiate themselves without having some kind of assistance, like a ladder, for example, climbing over your fence.
I have a quick question about that. Our tower site's being donated to us by a car dealership person who has a car lot, and they have like a mechanics area. Their whole lot's fenced in, but their employees, as it is now, where the tower is, how the tower is, as it is now, their employees would still be able to access the bottom of the tower. Is that, how is that?
Well, they're upright. Is this a metal tower?
Yeah.
It's also like a triangular tower?
Yeah.
That's sitting on the ground?
Yeah.
Okay, the easiest thing to do is put what's called an anti-climb skirt. You can just take a piece of sheet metal and wrap it around and run up 6 feet up the tower.
Okay.
And that way somebody would have to get a ladder to get above that skirt. Then you don't have to build a fence. You just have to prevent people from doing it. Or you could put a ring of barbed wire, 6 feet there or something, that they'd have to,
How tall is your tower?
It's like 69, 60, 70 feet.
Okay, yeah. Just put an anti-climb skirt on it.
Yeah.
Just go out and get some galvanized sheet metal and wrap it around. You don't have to build a fence.
Okay.
But that's what it talks about. Now, a lot of LPFMs are going to do rooftop antennas. Okay? So the question becomes, can somebody just climb up on the roof without a ladder or without going through a hatch? If they can get to it from a hatch, you better lock that hatch with a padlock.
But a key hatch is okay. If he's got a lock hatch.
Yeah. Yeah. A lock hatch. We actually had one installation where we did all these things, and you have to use a ladder. The FCC still made us put RF radiation signs on the roof. So, but that was in the CP, so we followed it. Tower painting, if required, must be maintained. Power lights must be monitored. You're probably not going to get into this unless you're building a tunnel tower or near an airport. Now, the way the rules are now, the tower owner has the primary responsibility to maintain the paint. So if you're leasing from somebody else, it's really their primary responsibility for the lights and the paint. But I'll tell you, if somebody gets hurt or a plane hits that tower, they're going to sue everybody. And so if you're on a tower and the lights are out and you don't own the tower, take a proactive tell the owner you better get those lights and keep after them, because the FCC may not get you, but somebody else might.
Well, if that light is out and somebody reports it, your station is also liable for a fine, not just the tower owner.
And one of the things that we recommend also is, you know, like, even if it's a donated space, even if, you know, it seems it's a small kind of thing or something, is to have this well articulated on whoever's land it is, what the responsibilities of that tower are, and what the expectations are, and the liabilities for the station and for them. Have that all articulated and so that clear expectations all around.
I co-manage a 600-foot tower with 9 FM stations on it, and all of the FM stations on there are independently monitoring the tower lights with their own things. We've got backups and backups and backups. I monitor as a tower manager, and then all the stations do also. EAS, the first thing the inspector will look for. Your box got to be properly programmed. And programming, if you've never done it, is pretty confusing. So my suggestion is, if you've never done this, get some help. Your local regional, your regional EAS coordinators can probably help. I'm sure there's some engineers in your market that probably have done this before. They can, you know, pay for their time to have it. If they've done it before, they can do it in a couple of hours. If you've never done it before, you're going to get in your head all day. And you need to have an EAS log. Now, with LPFM, you're not conducting tests, but you are receiving tests, and you need to relay those tests and alerts, of course. And so most of the modern machines have an electronic log that you can get to from any computer. So if you don't keep a paper log, at least be aware of how you get to the electronic logs and be ready to show the inspector if they ask you.
Mike, I'm sorry, really? Yes. The LPFMs don't have to say this is a test?
The LPFMs don't conduct their own tests.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. But you have to relay the required monthly tests and alerts. So that's it for the top 10.
And wherever they find it, the station when they walk in has to know how to get to the EAS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really, everybody who's going to be alone in the station should know how to get to this. Actually, everybody who's going to be alone at the station during business hours should know where everything that the FCC inspector might ask for, even if they have to read the directions. But at least have written directions on how they do that for them. And ideally, bring them through the process so they can do
that. This is also one of the other recommendations we have as part of what your orientation process has to well developed so that you're touching on these bases of every new member of the station that might be playing this type of role and have these type of responsibilities, so that it's not the first time they're hearing about it, but
So just a clarifying question, the EAS log is separate. It's its own log.
It can be part of your quote-unquote station log. Some people say, since the logging requirements are so simple, let's just make one master. Donna, I guess she's not here.
No, she's not in the room. She's
she has some samples. If you track down Donna to be the office, she has some nice consolidated station logs that do a good job of this.
And you can also hire Donna to come to your station and train everyone to be professional at that.
Most stations still keep a separate EAS log and do it on paper. But it doesn't happen.
Well, most EAS, or the newer ones, will update your log for a test automatically.
All right, that's all right after this.
Thank you.
not at the other presenters for this session. Do you guys have anything to add? Let's see, that would be Michi and Bonito. Okay. Go ahead.
Not particularly. I mean, one of the things to think about is sort of the risks you're facing, and so it helps to know which things are fines and which things are shut down, and how likely they are to happen to you. The other thing to keep in mind is how many people don't like you, because they're the ones who are likely to call if they think something's amiss. So make friends.
Any more questions about this area? Okay, let's move on to timeline, budgets, and checklists. This is a biggie. And Tom and Alan, would you say a little something about yourselves before you start talking? When, that's not possible. Before you start presenting.
I'm Tom Voorhees, and I've been in the communications racket for, what, some 15 years, something like that. I've really gotten into community radio the last, what, 5 or 6 years, something like that, out of PTFP funding being yanked by the Congress here a while back. Decided that we needed to get some of these things up and running, and I've been pretty much donating my time to that. You can hire me, I need to eat too. So what I'm going to do here is, the schedule has kind of got... They have the budget stuff here also next after the break, and I'm just going to go through the timeline at this point. And explain that. There's the timeline. Probably didn't make enough copies of it, but some of you have hard copies. You can follow along if you like.
How many do not have a hard copy?
I want to get one more for the guy who I told that.
Okay, well, up until early this morning, it was posted on the GRC website, and it disappeared somehow. We will get that up there again, along with the material list and stuff. And like I just said, we'll go through the material list after the break. So anyway, how you read this thing, what it is, it's a visual way to illustrate what needs to be done in a logical sequence through the construction process. And if you read down from the green arrow that points down, that's each logical step, okay, in order. And you need to try to maintain the logical steps in order. If you start skipping around, you're going to create more problems, you know, to get through. And I don't recommend that at all. Reading across ways, that's it in time. Your original permit is good for 18 months. Okay? If there is one 18-month extension available, which you have to apply for 2 or 3 weeks before it expires, or you're just dead, it's gone, right? So that's very important. I'm not sure. We can go through all of these items down the list. I don't think we need to do that.
There's time for it, John.
Pardon?
There's enough time for you to do that.
You have 25 minutes. So.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to spend 25 minutes on this. We will make that all different next week. Alan's probably got some comments. I'm not sure that Alan has seen this before. But
switch.
Go ahead.
Say something about yourself, Alan.
Hi, my name is Alan Gomez with this radio project. My background came in doing a lot of international radio builds and communities throughout particularly Latin America that invariably crossed our paths early on over a decade ago, I believe, with Petri, Prometheus, and all the work that they were doing. So it was a really wonderful opportunity when I came back to the States from being abroad to be able to connect with it in this really exciting time. I mean, it's been an exciting
already,
10 years, but it's extremely exciting to know that all these markets that are coming up. So part of what we had also tried to create like a cookie cutter kind of model of timeline, budget, and all these other things. But the way that we found it to be best is to have a much more specific type of document to work from for each LPFM that we were working with. We had organized dozens, if not hundreds, of different groups across the country and been working pretty closely with a fair number of, well over 200, close to 300 applicants. So what we designed was a station building assessment. So based on about an hour-long conversation, we go over, review the CP, some of the requirements, do some ask a lot of questions to get a clear understanding of what the particular needs and what the particular wants and goals are for the organization in their building. From that, we help design a reasonable timeline of activity with some detailed notes and some links to some of our resources that we have in those particular areas. We also apply in there some of our availability to be able to help with a lot of these items. Some of them very much parallel what Tom has on his list. And then from that, we also design a budget, a budget to help with fundraising and help have some particular goals around equipment, recommended according to the size and, like I said, the aspirations of the station based on our discussion. And also a sample operational budget to not keep in mind just like the building, but also like how to run for the first year and what some typical expenses are. Some of the things we asked specifically, like what are your best estimations about certain utility costs that the station might be running, as well as some other costs that we determined based on surveys of many different LPs that have already been in operation. So there's a number of different notes and explanations of different kind of line items for that. So this is the overall budget, giving you some target goals. Scroll up a little. So, yeah, down. keep rolling the... This way. Yeah. Okay. There's bottom line and kind of separated. We also include in there, because we are also available to help do the build, you know, what our availability would be, and also what the cost would be to hire a police wonderful work. And so then also we then break it out into equipment, specific equipment budget, based on, like I said, the needs. So there's a transmission equipment budget breakout. Just keep scrolling. There's the on-air studio equipment budget breakout. And also then, depending if this is also a goal, a production studio budget for you. And so these all vary from each station organization based on what, you know, they said, this is what we're hoping for. So that's kind of what we put together. Then we also asked some other specific location studio kind of like things, and we create a rudimentary idea kind of like generating studio layouts and recommendations about, you know, like where, how to develop that space. And a little perky thing that we can use to help generate. One of the things, the reason we include something like that is, as very basic as it is that it kind of helps create a tangible vision for a lot of groups. Some of the work that we do in that discussion is also like figuring out strategies around organizing, getting all those different kind of like organizational components together to help with fundraising, help developing committees, help developing basically the many hands kind of coordinating together to meet some of these goals. And one other part, actually, if we can scroll back close to the beginning, another part is that just as this document. Here we outline, you know, how much things would cost if bought through us, because we're also working with a number of different vendors and bulk purchasing on certain times. Go back to that. Now it's good. On this document here, it's got times set along the side, basically from the time that we start the discussion, how many weeks you have remaining, and then also times to check in with us and if you wanted to move forward with a bulk purchase, as well as our availability for hire to
done Alan? You've done Michael? Oh, yeah, I guess you know what I'm doing. You've done Tom.
I just want to say one thing. If you go to the next page, there's on the timeline itself, there's a set of notes that that correspond to all of the different lines and stuff on there. And it's down to the next page. That's where they start there. And they're attached to the hard copies. And again, all of this will be hopefully posted again here before the end of the day on the DRC website. That's it, Betty.
Okay. Any more questions for these fine gentlemen?
I have a question. I brought our budget and that we put together KGZR, and I'm wondering if at some point later in the day be able to sit down with somebody with any of you to kind of look it over and make sure it's in the same with what you guys recommend. It's looking good to me, but I don't want to make sure.
Yeah, we'll actually we'll also meet this up because also we'll be sitting at a table over there. We'll have a little team, some of us will take in and out, so folks will come in.
First thing you have up here is project manager. What kind of budget allotment should we be thinking about trying to come up with to have a project manager?
Well, you can, as neat as you can research this even online, but my Warehouse 21 just put me on board part-time. I mean, you guys come in, normally it's some public radio project manager full-time at $40,000, $38,000, $40,000 a year. They brought me on right now just part-time. And I'm not even going to say anything because it's really pathetic, but it's out of, you know, the love of what we're doing. So you're looking at some full-time project manager, full-time for a year, probably between 38 and 40 something a year. But we found that with LPF, with a little LPFM, you can bring me in. I'm in part-time right now because I teach college and ostensibly getting half of that, you know, well, not even close right now.
Well, most LPFMs don't take a year to build.
Exactly.
These gentlemen and lady will be available later in the day. At the end, after all the prepared statements, we have a 25-minute segment of questions and time to set up a time to have a more in-depth meeting with you. Okay?
I've got one other thing to say about project managers. It's very important to not change, if at all possible, to not change project managers in the middle of trying to get your station up and on the air. You'll lose a lot of continuity. Project managers carry a lot of things around in your head, and you don't want to lose that. So try to hang on to the same person through the completion of the project.
Tom, in your timeline, you have the filing the 319 for the license taking a month. So to file and to get it, if that's what we should expect.
Yeah, and Michael is more qualified to speak about that than I am. You're probably going to need your lawyer or an engineer to file that for you.
Okay.
The two documents that are attached to this, and Michael can tell you about that too, whoever's in charge of the project can file those. And those are just kind of notifications that more is coming to the FCC. Michael?
Well, I'll just make it real brief. What you're supposed to do is file a notification with the FCC for when you begin equipment tests. The moment you have any kind of signal of any level that's going to go over the air, you are beginning your equipment tests. You're supposed to file a notification. Their preferred method is by fax, believe it or not. And then program tests. If you have automatic program test authority, which almost all of you will, you're supposed to file that. Another fax letter, simple two lines indicating you're putting program testing. Within 10 days of program testing, you're expected to go on the air and file once you begin program testing, you actually are operating on the air within with normal operation. Within 10 days of that, you're supposed to file your 319 application for station license. And
so there's a cushion between actually testing the channel that you have
yeah.
and having that license.
Yeah. Now, you're not going to get your license right away, but as soon as you file your 319, actually, as soon as you file your notification of beginning of program testing, you can operate normally. And however long the FCC takes to get back to you with a real license, you can operate as if you were licensed.
The ball's in their court.
Yeah. And
you've done your part.
You've done your part. And that program test notification and the 319 have got to be in before the CP expires. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
To go back to the project manager thing real quick, I think a lot of LPFMs are planning on just having somebody of their own kind of follow the project through. Do you think that's realistic as opposed to paying somebody? Because I don't think most of us planned on hiring an expensive project manager to come in and do this part.
You don't have to hire somebody. The important thing is that the person that's going to do it sticks through it all the way to the end, right, until you're on the air. So you don't start losing pieces of it here and there.
You're just pointing out you can't have a committee basically do it. It's got to
be
one
person. No, you've got to have one, almost one central person that keeps all the pieces together.
Okay.
And that person, you don't have one person and then 6 months later another one person. It's one person the whole way. And sometimes if you pay, you're more likely to get them to stay the whole way. we all work with volunteers, and we know that volunteers are lovely people and they really believe, but if something comes up, they can be just gone.
Yeah, there's actually a feature that we're going to be talking about, you know, like volunteers and
yeah.
the challenges and rewards of it a little bit later, so I don't want to sidetrack too much into that. But one of the things, I mean, I'm a big advocate for committees, but committees doesn't mean like distributing the responsibility, so no one's eyeballing it, right? So the project, you know, manager, someone is like basically the way we use it, like having someone who's keeping track of all the different things that need to be done. When we do the assessments, we do ask for specifically for who is our point of contact. Mm-hmm. So effectively, that person would be filling that role. Mm-hmm. And typically, it's been all volunteers that are in that, but it's a person who is coordinating with us, and then we know that they're delegating to either other volunteers or other core members of their group. So obviously, many different models and many different types of ways and human, you know, availability of different people to take on different tasks, but you know, it's definitely working for a lot of different groups to have that point of contact or that principal person who can kind of like hold you
everything. Yeah, just let me underscore that really quickly. I mean, try to maintain one person through the duration of the project as a single point of contact. If you start mixing other people in there, you're going to get things confused. Somebody's going to say one thing, somebody's going to say something else to a, you know, to a tower erector or whoever it is. So really try hard to do that.
Any more questions? Yes.
I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time in the day to ask, but is there a hierarchy of people that should be put in place at the outset? In other words, we've got a project manager.
Yeah.
Who else should you have?
Donna DiBianco brought me in because she's like, I got 1,200 to deal with. You work with KGZ, you know, with KGZR. But I think everything's different. I mean, I'm listed as project manager. James Buck, this 21-year-old kid, is sort of our operations and tech manager. He is dealing with all the tech, all the equipment stuff, all the costs. I wish we could have gotten him here for this, because it would have been dynamite. But so, I mean, that's, right now, it's just the two of us are doing that piece. And then the rest are all volunteers, all these kids, because it's a youth center, a youth organization. But I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, so ideally, this perfect world kind of thing is that you have tons of different people to support you. You have a very large support mechanism. It's not you know, it's going to vary from place to place. Some people, it's two people building this from scratch, right? So can you have more than two roles at that moment, right? It's like, no, there's no one else.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons why we think in terms of, well, why the organization in terms of developing committees and other roles and responsibilities early on, identifying where you could plug people into, you know, and then also kind of like assessing who has different capabilities, different people. Some people are really great at pitching this idea of this station. They would be like, oh, you're going to go in the fundraising committee. You know, maybe you don't want to, you know, understand the operations of tech kind of thing, but you're really great at reaching out and connecting with people and raising those $500, $1,000, $10,000. You know, so, but if you design that so that there's a space, there's certain kind of like categories of support, then it's much easier to find and be able to fill those places in, as opposed to if you're just kind of have this ambiguous kind of work that needs to be done, and only one person is kind of overseeing it constantly, then the work is going to fall always to that one person, because there isn't an articulated function for, you know, for other people.
And they're in the FCC, I mean, in the booklet, the guidelines, it says right there, designate an underwriter who has, two to five years professional experience in underwriting. Designate a, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you're looking for people within your community, within the organization that can do that. Unfortunately, some of us don't have that. So it's trying to find those people in the community that might be willing to volunteer to give their time to do it for you.
And these things happen concurrently with building a station and building your, you know, your building the station physically and building the station with individuals. And the earlier that it can happen, the building the people part, the community part of the station, the earlier that it can happen, the more buy-in that people have as they start to see the station coming alive, like the physical space, the equipment, the, you know, the content being produced, the early stages of its identity being shared publicly for the first time to the surrounding community. So it's a really exciting phase. But it is also a very challenging phase, because it's not necessarily tangible as once you already have a non-air project. Right, so it really does kind of need to be fleshed out as clear as possible, and also with what type of expectations. Because I think one of the challenges that a lot of volunteers, and like I said, we're going to talk about this later, but one of the challenges is if you feel you're a volunteer and failing at your role, then pretty soon you're going to be like, well, I'm not going to volunteer.
Right.
And maybe the expectations weren't very clear. You weren't sure, what can I contribute?
Now, you mentioned booklet. What was that booklet?
Well, they're just the FCC guidelines. We have, when we, when Warehouse 21 received license for the FCC, everything is in there. Everything you need to know. And I mean, I sat down and combed over that thing with a fine-tooth comb. That was redundant. And, but I know that, you know, there are certain people, things we need, and unfortunately the organization doesn't have the money to do it. So what we're trying to do is find those within the organization who are willing to do it. And Tom knows about this, and Donna, they helped get this rocking and rolling at KGCR. Is there anything you would add to that, Tom?
Well, I mean, if you're going to divide up project responsibilities toward the overall project manager and say your chief engineer, okay, just respect each other's responsibility.
Okay.
Don't be making decisions to people off to the side without corresponding with the person that's really responsible for making them.
Okay.
Don't make it, I mean, if you're the manager, don't make engineering decisions. Okay, refer those kind of decisions to your engineering person, and the opposite of that.
And I think the biggest problem we've had so far, just an example of how this is all coming together, is, you know, James is our operations engineer, but our board, we have a couple board members that keep trying to micromanage, but they know nothing about me. And so it's very difficult to get them to shut the up, stay out of it, and let James do his job, let me do my job, and this will all come to fruition. So sometimes I think it's hard because the board has a vested interest as well, but they
Well, let me put a plug in. I'm going to be co-presenting with two other people tomorrow, a workshop on governance. And one of the main things that we talk about is that division of roles between the board, which is to govern, and the staff, which is to manage.
Exactly.
So great. Great. And some of the folks in here are in MX situation and would not have received those guidelines.
I didn't bring them with me. I was going to bring a whole freaking folder, and I forgot. But I think you can get them online.
It could be.
You should do that. I appreciate it. You can get them. They're online, and you can download them. They're downloadable.
Okay.
Yes.
Michi, we do have a little time if you want to talk about those filings.
About what filing?
So you're not to your neck.
Well, the thing was, this was added to the agenda, and actually, honestly, I don't remember what this actual item was about. So
okay.
That's the reason why I'm kind of...
maybe it's on the checklist. You will need to do various filings with the FCC along the roads, particularly renewing your license. On a timely manner. But there are others.
Yeah, we are going to have later in the day, we are going to have a piece on the life cycle issues that come up during your day, in your day-to-day life as an LPFM station. There's going to be things that are going to come up that are going to require you to need to take action, file with the FCC, make changes and such like that. We'll talk about that this afternoon.
Okay.
So
now, all of you have to understand that I've been wrangling 8 engineers for the last couple of months, and there may have been a misunderstanding about where that particular stuff goes.
You know, and also understand that a lot of us right now are working right now with the MX window that is currently open right now in the western U.S. We just recently came out of a petition to deny filing deadline, so a lot of us have been very busy.
Okay, well, let's go on to Pete. Pete's got a fun thing to tell us about.
I think I'm going to switch the
format. Well, tell us about yourself. Okay.
My name is Pete Tredich. I founded the Community Australia Project. I managed to escape about 2 or 3 years ago. Now I'm just working as a freelance engineer, project manager for Station Band on the Air. I'm going to switch format on it just because.
That's a Pete thing.
Yeah, just because a lot of it's already been covered, and I think we should move to more of a questions and answers thing.
Sure.
about some of the worst mistakes you can make while you're building. I'll throw out a couple of ideas just to get us started, and we won't go too deep into anyone's individual case, but we can just talk a little bit about some of your questions, worries, doubts, insecurities. So, first one question for y'all. Last time you bought a t-shirt, how much was it?
$20.
$20? How much? other costs?
$10.
$10? $2.50? Can I hear a dollar?
Yeah.
Okay. 50 cents? Yeah. Okay, so we've gotten 50 cents to $20. 50 cents was a goodwill. $3 from the child labor in China, $10, for something kind of reasonable, $20 to support a cause that you believe in, $30 for organic hand-combed cotton from the Andes. So you can spend all kinds of different money for the same thing. So that's the frustration when people ask me, how much does it cost to build a radio station? Because my first radio station I built for $800. I also could have gone to jail for it.
Yeah.
And so, on the other hand, other people will spend, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $250,000. And it depends on whether you want to sit on milk crates with bare light bulbs in the studio, or whether you want a Trans Am sort of Maserati of a radio station. So it reflects, how much you spend reflects more on you than it reflects on the actual cost of what it is. There are a couple of baseline things that we're going to get into more with the equipment lists, transmitters, you can't really make them yourself. Emergency alert, very difficult to get around. you know, so you've got like $5,000 or $6,000 that almost everybody is going to have to do it that way, except for like the 1% of people that come up with some like crazy other scheme. But then beyond that, there's a lot of other choices you have. The other thing is, you know, if you had a PTFP grant, like people did, you know.
Does everyone know what a PTFP grant is?
No, that's the old grant that the government would pay 50 to 75% of the cost of starting a radio station. And those were awesome, a lot of paperwork. But yeah, if you've got that, fly your tower in on a helicopter, land it on a mountaintop, you know, hire the UFO army to build the whole thing. You know, it's like, great. Those are gone due to our failure as advocates to keep that program in place. And, you know, so now, you know, the money's, a lot of the things that engineers were used to being able to purchase because, you know, the government was splitting half the bill, they're kind of off the table for us in a lot of ways. So some things in terms of like how much you expect in terms of reliability, not using consumer gear but pro gear, they're more complicated when you're paying every penny of the price of the thing that you're building. Also, the other thing is you're going to need all kinds of different expertise, and every different station is going to have a different set of people that comes to the table. And so some stations, the easiest thing is going to be to find that nerd engineer that doesn't have any friends, that like, this is the best thing that ever happened to them, is they get to build the team. All of a sudden they're popular, like people call them, like, you know, and they will spend all their time for free like building the radio station for you. You know, some places you don't find that person, and you've got to hire someone to train some people to do that part. You know, other places it's the accountant. Favorite story, Gandhi's autobiography. This young man comes up to Mahatma Gandhi. He says, "Gandhiji, I will do anything for the movement against British rule in India. I will tie myself to train tracks. I will, you know, I will starve myself for like months. Anything you want me to do, I'm going to do it." And he looks at him and says, "I want you to go to accounting school. I cannot find a good bookkeeper for the life of me, and we're losing money all over the place. I cannot find anyone that will do this job for us." And so, I don't know if he was willing to go that far in his commitment to the movement against the government, but you know, so every station is going to have a different set of people that come to the table and talents, and so your cost, you know, when you ask most people what costs money in radio, it's like, oh, well, yeah, it's the pay Howard Stern. I mean, he's really expensive to get your announcers, you know, and that's something in community radio that almost nobody gets paid for doing a program. So you're going to just need to assess, like, you're basically going to have some technical needs, some of them having to do with the radio and transmitter, which not very many people know about, some having to do with audio, which is a kind of a more common set of skills because a lot of musicians know how to do recording. Then there's a set of sort of engineering problems and fundraising and promotion sort of problems. And it's hard because everybody has a different sense of like what they would happily do for fun and camaraderie, and what is a giant pain in the neck that like, I would never do that if you paid me $1 million. I would only do that if you paid me. So, you know, you're going to really need to do your own sort of assessment of your skill. One or two other values I just want to throw out there, just a couple of the common things people don't think about. Studios are much more forgiving than transmitters. You know, I actually kind of like it, like that station that I built for $800. I built it with some broken old record players and tape decks. And what happened was, I didn't build it very well, and it gave a great opportunity for the DJs to be like, "Petrie is a numbskull. I am going to bring my my extra CD player home because this thing is broken." And so The studio actually, first of all, it has a beautiful origin myth, the moment when we were all like sitting under the railway poles in the back of the house. But also, it's an opportunity for people to bring and improve and modify. You're going to find that you want to modify your studio anyway after a year based on changing technology. I mean, 5 years ago, everyone would have said, put in mini disc players into the, On the other hand, like, a lot of people say, don't put any turntables in, like, that's so 1952. But, I don't know, people are still using turntables, So you're going to probably change your studio around anyway, and that is something that is the most forgiving. Towers, the biggest thing I've learned in doing towers for the past couple of years is that like about 80% of the work and cost is underground, not above ground. I mean, once you're actually building the tower, it's just like an erector set, and you're just like, stacking things on top of each other. But excavations and avoiding pipelines that you didn't know were there, and like digging permits, all that kind of thing, and also inspectors that are very picky about how concrete is poured and set up, that's big. So, think about the underground when you're doing towers, not as much about the overground. One other thing, some people are too expert. You very well may get someone, like Ron's going to yell at me about this, but you may very well get someone that comes to the station and they're like, I am an audiophile. I can hear the difference between, frequencies between 15,000 and 17,000. And you have to buy, this kind of, super thick cable that,
Might not be the best person
to decide your equipment list, even though they're a volunteer and they're donating you their time. 85% of people can't hear that. And by the time it goes to the FM audio chain, you can hear the difference, between some of these things. Another thing, men should not be radio engineers. By the age of 18, we have lost most of our ability to hear frequencies over 12,000 or so. And so there's a whole world of things that men can't judge and hear that women can. So make sure a woman is listening to your sound. Or building whole things, preferably for children. Yeah. Let's see. I think those were a couple things I wanted to hit on, and I wanted to just move it to I'm gonna bring up some specific questions about things you're most worried about. I'm gonna just leave you with one more thing. Engineers always say, fast, cheap, good. Pick two. You can manage fast and cheap, you can manage cheap and good, but all three, it's just not bad.
I have a question quick. I missed a little bit of what you said for the $800 station. Was that a stereo signal that you sent out for $800, or was it mono?
That was stereo, and it was pirate. So it did not use an FCC approved. It was before the FCC actually decided that LPFM had that certified transmitters, and it was in no way certified. Yeah, it was like a $300 can. And it's important to realize about the certification. That was a specifically anti-pirate jab from certain people in the Office of Engineering and Technology. They wanted to make sure that Stephen Dunford did not go into the transmitter business and make his living by selling transmitters after this was all passed. So the certification process cost about $10,000 to $15,000. It's actually a more stringent requirement for low power family transmitters than for full power transmitters, which is actually merely a type verification, which is a different level of verification. It's important to know about communications law is that just because it's a technical subject does not mean that it is rational. It is political. And there are different decisions that are made at different moments that stick over the years, and they frequently contradict each other. So if you understand communications law, not as a rational system of governing the airwaves, but as a series of political compromises and what one party could impose its will over others, then it all makes. I won't go that far. It can be understood what you're dealing with. Other questions about?
Our particular situation, we are in talks with the local housing authority about putting our antenna on one of their buildings. How dangerous is that?
Well, that's a good one.
Housing authority.
Your radiation is not so very dangerous. You know, your distance limit is going to be like 13, 20, whatever feet, where nobody should be taking a shower, you know, like eating, you know, that sort of thing, sticking around. In terms of like being able to stay there, you know, so much is political with, you know, local appointees and that sort of thing. If you get a lease, I don't think it's more dangerous than anything else you could get. You know, most commercial tenancies, you know, that they're doing it because they want money from you and they want to get it every month. So, you know, I have one station that I've worked with, Mockley, Florida, for 10 years now. They have been afraid to put their transmitter and their antenna on a tower because they've been afraid of some local elites getting mad at them and turning off the station. Because of that, they've kept their tower. No FCC officers anymore. they were supposed to build at 100 feet. They are currently at about 35 feet. Alan was there when we put this tower up. So they've been getting like probably a quarter of the coverage they should get because they've been afraid that someone one day might screw with them by not having the tower on their land. And I've been like, dude, just rent a tower. And they've also been totally obstructed in the course of trying to build their own tower by local zoning. And just because they're paranoid doesn't mean someone's not up to them. But they have effectively, you know, screwed themselves out of a lot of coverage they could have because they were nervous about entering into a contract with someone that might be a joke.
Can you just briefly explain the remote transmitting? Like, so I think this is what you're talking about, but explain how it works. Like, so you can have your tower over here, but you can have
your station. A transmitter link, yeah.
Yeah, your station, yeah. Like a wire.
We're going to talk about that later on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure. It was a big deal about 10, 15 years ago. Very hard to do, very expensive, and it's a lot easier now. A lot easier to do with off-the-shelf components than it used to be.
This might be a myth, but I've heard that once you have the license, once you have your station established, you can then later reapply and expand your signal, like in 5 years or 6 years?
There's not a simple way of doing that. There are lots of tricky things you can do. That you could, but there's not a simple path
no
from power to full power.
Okay.
It's not like you go and pay for an upgrade and get a better seat. You know, it's like you have to apply for a different license. You might apply for translators or boosters or that sort of thing, but it's not.
Well, first of all, you have to wait for another application window to open. Right? And who knows when that's going to be. To go full power from an LP.
But are there ways to tweak that you can improve your signal, Michael?
So every once in a while you can. You know, you can do minor modifications up to 6 kilometers. If you can go someplace higher, if a station goes off the air that was limiting you before, you might be able to do an engineering amendment and switch to a better channel if you didn't want to be clearance. So there are certain ways you can buy a translator from someone that already has one. And, you know, people put them on the market when they're not using them anymore or if you offer them the right price. So there are a lot of options.
Last question. We're in Rochester, which is like right across the lake from Toronto, Canada, and different places. And on some of the signals that are supposed to be like clear, like that we're playing for, we're getting bombarded by Canadian signals. Does the FCC not? We can't do anything about that because it's a different country. It's like Radio Canada. Like,
so are you on the air yet? Or?
No.
Okay.
We're just trying to be.
LPFMs are not protected from incoming interference in any way. However, if there's another available open channel that has less interference, and you're just getting amped, the commission will usually allow you to move to that other open channel with a proper technical show. So if you just pick the band frequency and there's a better one out there, would you consider doing it? You may actually have to go on the air first, though.
Yeah.
We'll let you do that.
There's another piece of this.
Actually, that's not correct.
That's not correct?
No, not at all. I've done several of them.
Before, okay.
I've done several of them. I just compared the two contour overlap studies, and if I can show them that the new channel is outside the interference contour of the full power station, and I will usually give population numbers. I'll say that this new channel will give an extra 11,000 people interference-free LPFM service. They'll buy them. They bought every single one I put in.
Before
it was ever on the air.
Yeah. And there's another warning that I offer to people. If you're not on the air, then you don't really know how strong your signal is going to be relative to the others. If you're in a good car radio, you can pick up all kinds of shit. And then when you go on the air, it's going to drown it out.
There's something called capture ratio that with FM, AM is not licensed, but FM, fortunately, you just have to have the wanted signal be a few decibels stronger than the unwanted. The unwanted, at least in theory, goes away completely. In a moving car, though, you can have things popping in and out, and it gets a little frustrating. So to be really reliable, you want your wanted signal to be 20 decibels stronger than the unwanted. There are some of us can do maps to figure this out for you and actually figure where the interference will be. You want to do that?
And if you can't get around that, working with your transmitter and your antenna, one solution is to get a directional receiving antenna and put it up on top of your house. You may be able to null out other interfering stations from either Canada or Mexico.
But it's this way, even if you're not on the Canadian border, this is a problem everywhere. There's no protection from incoming.
Other questions?
Yeah, low power FMs are allowed two translators at this point? Is that And is that something we need to wait until we're actually on the air before we look into that, or we can start investigating now?
Well, there's no window, though.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Is it
you can
wait
one.
For another window, or is there going to be a window?
You can always buy them. It's going to be a while.
Being prepared to spend a lot of money if you try to buy one, because especially if you're near a bigger city, they're worth lots of bucks.
A translator just went in Chicago, $4 million.
Even Syracuse, New York, which is a relatively small market, we just got two offers of $100,000 cash each to sell our translator frequency only. No equipment, no tower, no nothing. Just the frequency, $100,000 cash. They said we'll put it on the table right now if you walk away. $100,000 for Syracuse, New York, which is a relatively small market.
And you said yes.
And what did you say?
No, we said hello. we need that. That's key to our coverage plan.
The translator, you have to be able to receive it through the air, and a bit of the translator coverage contour has to intersect with the coverage contour of the LPFM. So you can't have one.
If it's the same owner. If it's the same owner.
Because
Hood River is getting around that by having a different owner.
That's true.
If you want to come and if you want a commonly owned translator with your LPFM, that is correct. And it also has to be within 10 or miles or 20 miles based on your market.
Yeah, non-commonly owned. There's an LPFM that now has three translators in the gorge.
Yeah.
Three. And so just by having it owned by a different person, they're exempt from all those limitations.
But those translators still have to receive the station.
Yeah, still have to receive it through the air, which sometimes is very different.
More questions?
To remember these prices when everybody says radio is dying.
FM translators in many cases are worth more than a full power AM station in the same market in this point. Yeah, in fact, there was a straight across trade within the last couple of years in the AM for translators.
We're online only right now, and our engineers are mainly musicians. You know about sound engineering, and we've been able to work with them so far. I'm imagining once we get to the building, our antenna will need an engineer who's more familiar with FM broadcasting. Would you agree? And if so, where would we begin finding that person, and how much would we have to spend on them? Is it a part-time on-call kind of thing?
I don't think you need to keep an engineer that's familiar with FM. You probably just need someone to hire someone to come and help put it in. I mean, most of the musicians, you know, if they're familiar with audio, it's not like it's rocket science. I don't think any of us that are engineers went to school for it. I mean, a bunch of us are certified engineers, no less, and that means that we passed a multiple choice test. I actually studied for the wrong thing and I still passed it. So the RF, you know, it isn't something most people know, but it's not incredibly complicated. And once it's running, you don't need someone all the time there to do it. You probably just need to hire someone to help set it up, like that part. A bunch of us do it.
When you're shopping for it, you're looking for a contract project engineer. Would be the language that would be the buzzwords for you. It's a contract project engineer. Some engineers do it by job. Some engineers do it by the hour. And so you can assess at that point. But you're going to expect probably a good 70 to 90 hours of work. That's just straight installation. That's not anything else. But that's about what you're going to be looking for.
And where
would
we
look? Where are you looking?
Where's Louisville? I mean, do we put a call out on our social media?
Yeah. Different people are in a different way. Actually, like right now, I'm driving cross country and I'm working on a bunch of stations, and so I just like sort of schedule a bunch of people, and they all do it kind of differently too. You know, you can look at your local SBE chapter, SBE
Society of Broadcast Engineers,
State Association of Broadcasters,
SBE.org.
Some engineers like to go on a retainer system where you pay them a couple $100 a year, and if something comes up, they will help you out. On it. Others will charge you by the hour, by the day. Sometimes you want to think about the qualifications of the person that you're hiring. Like, Mike can do anything in radio engineering, but then you have to pay him to be able to do anything, and most of his capabilities it's too much, you know, he's too good for what you're looking for. So you want to think about like matching the skill level to what you need, you know. You might be able to find someone that, you know, that can only do the part that you need.
With that in mind, we're going to have the same issue, and I'm hoping and planning to create a maker space to go along with my radio station. And do you have a model like that in your mind in the nation?
Urbana has a makerspace in there's also a makerspace that applied in Colorado for the California. So I think it's a great synergy. People that are involved in a makerspace, like, you know, they'll need to like read a couple of articles online and, you know, it'll all make sense to that. You know, it's good to have someone that has some with RF to like, you know, check over your final plan and that kind of thing. But, you know, because people do have these kind of new, different expectations of their devices, you know, that don't quite apply in the world of
cotton stuff. Would ham radio operators, licensed radio operators, be of assistance in that arena?
Hams can be great, and also, and I already said this, but I'll emphasize that engineers from full power stations can be great, but like double check what they think, because a lot of times they're thinking of a lot of old rules that don't actually apply to you. I've had numerous very knowledgeable people tell me low power fans absolutely have to have a public file. And it's because, like, back in 1972, when they worked at a radio station, it took up half their time, and they were, like, doing public file, and, you know, and they were traumatized by it. But LPFM doesn't have one. And it's the same with various technical requirements. You know, there are things that engineers are accustomed to doing that, you know, that have been deregulated and are not. Just double check. You know, have two or three opinions. It's like a doctor. You don't want to. You want to trust your expert, but you also, you know, want them to, like, you know, get some feedback.
Do your research. Honestly, is another thing. Is do your research into their backgrounds and what their success rates are. That is not a bashful question to ask. How many stations have you put on the air successfully? How many stations have you, you know, are you overseeing as chief? Because sometimes they might be too busy, and they say, yeah, we'll help you, and up there, call the way to Kilo drop a monster antenna on a mountaintop. So you also want to check their availability. Part of that is doing that research on them, and that way you start creating the language. Engineers speak a different language than most people. you're going to want to get that under your belt also.
This is Donna DiBianco speaking. Your name's
hi.
Come up already. So.
Hi, oh, gosh. Okay. Hi.
In a good way.
Okay.
I would start with the nearest community station.
Yeah.
See who they use it for an engineer.
Yeah.
Because you want somebody who ideally is feels an affinity to your cause and will give you a really good rate.
let me make one distinction here.
Yeah.
Between an engineer like Michael and Michi over here that cut applications, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They're all called engineers. I'm called an engineer. I don't cut applications, but I actually build the actual station. And so have that distinction in mind when you're talking about engineers. And there's several of us, like myself, that don't do the paperwork of apps and stuff like that, but we're perfectly qualified to go out and assist you building your station.
And generally, an engineer like Tom, you get him a set of specs that have been approved by your engineer, he's on it. I mean, you know, that's the type of build that they work on. They get the set of specs from somebody that you've been working for, that you've approved, and then they'll start collaborating on the build-out. And it'll make it a much more streamlined opportunity for them to get that station on the air because they'll be able to connect with each other. So it's not the golden secret that, you know, somebody drew some specs for you. Okay. It's meant to be shared so people can carry out those piece parts and work collaboratively to get it on the air.
Other questions?
So at the risk of being redundant here, because I have been told this repeatedly regarding necessity for an engineer, currently for LPFMs, then there are no monthly sign-offs by an accredited engineer.
There's no chief, if you're talking about chief operator,
yeah.
There's actually no chief operator requirements
right.
At LPFM.
Right.
And no proof of performance requirement.
Right.
An
accreditation.
Although we recommend you do it, but yes,
right. An accreditation.
Right.
Necessary,
yes.
Unnecessary.
Not required, yeah.
Competency.
When you
is
say
what's required.
No.
That's why Don is saying do your research, right? Find somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Five minutes, folks.
Totally could have someone who self-taught to do the vast majority of it. You got what you pay for, you know, like in terms of like just like, you know, sometimes like, and not buying things.
you have to be careful because, I mean, we started with a volunteer engineer 15 years ago who got us a bunch of CPs, and we built one out just to find out it was completely worthless. We wasted our money, we wasted our time, and we killed our credibility in the community because we said, oh, we got this great thing, you're going to be able to hear it, and then you couldn't hear it, and we couldn't explain why, and we had to basically start over. It was horrible. And it's just because we didn't research what he could do, what his knowledge was, we trusted him, and, you know.
Ask for references.
Yeah.
You said something about you recommended doing a performance analysis or a performance test.
Proof of performance.
Proof of performance. What are you using?
This is a spectrum analysis of the transmitter after it's installed into the antenna. Make sure it's not generating intermods or harmonics interfering with other stations or with the aircraft bandwidth they really fancy about.
It was a requirement from back when most transmitters did not, from before when they invented the transistor, right? So most transmitters could wander, they could, like, have it heat up, they could start being on a different frequency, people could blow it in a lot of different ways. Most transmitters that you deal with now are much more reliable, and so the FCC in the 80s, I guess, they got rid of most of the requirements for them.
Well, for full power, it's still required to do the proof.
Yeah.
It's only low power that's exempt. But here's the thing. If you are co-located on a tower with other facilities, you really should get a proof done, because there is a realistic possibility of intermodulation, two frequencies combining with each other to form a third one. And if that third frequency is on top of aircraft and you're near an airport, you're going to get busted real fast. So I think it's a good idea to have this done, particularly if you're co-locating with any other kind of facility. And if you're all by yourself and you've got a brand new transmitter, the chances are pretty small that you've got a problem.
Well, I recommend that you do it anyhow.
Yeah.
And the reason I do that is because if something does come up, you got something to show the FCC that you have it together technically, right? After this complaint came in, and you can show the FCC that it wasn't for you. If it's a harmonic that's interfering with somebody else, you got something to prove that when you went on the air, that harmonic was not there. Okay, so that really protects you, right, if somebody tries to blame you for interference.
You'll need an experienced engineer with the spectrum analyzer and the line sections and other things to do it. They'll probably charge you $400 or $500 to do the proof. I agree.
Actually,
get it done, even though it's not required.
It reminds me of one more thing that we kind of do. When we were working on passing the power of
performance,
you all probably know it was a 10-year struggle. It took us a lot of work, a lot of, you know, pulling every kind of string we could learn how to do, and a lot of negotiations. And one of the things that we had to do in order to get it through, our opponents at the National Association of Broadcasters and NPR kept on bringing up this question of whether low-power FM stations would interfere. We always knew it was absolutely preposterous to really talk about substantial interference from low-power stations to full-power broadcasters. I mean, they're 50,000 watts and we're 100 watts. But there is some truth to the fact that for the first 200, 300, 400, 500 feet around your transmitter site, you can cause some interference to local listeners. And this is what took us years and years to resolve in a way that satisfied all the parties in such a way that the bill got that through. So, all this to say, if you get interference complaints from your neighbors, your immediate neighbors, you should be very careful of how you deal with them, because one of the things, the compromises that we had to make was we said, like, okay, any kind of interference that actually happens, not the theoretical interference that our opponents keep on saying is going to create an ocean of noise in the FM, but any actual complaints, we are going to deal with very promptly, and we are going to, like, turn off transmitters very quickly and then just do test broadcasts until we resolve them in a way that listener is happy. The chances that this will happen to you are really pretty small. I would guess maybe 1 in 10 of the groups here might experience something like that. But it's important to do it right. Call Prometheus or Mike or whoever to get some advice about how to handle the situation so that you don't, you know, your license doesn't end up in jeopardy. It is a kind of ridiculous burden of proof on us that is not on full power stations. Full power stations ignore most interference complaints that they get, and they almost never get busted for them. But in the case of low power FMs, you know, we have like three different semi-contradictory rules about like how to deal with these like horrible interference complaints that might flood into the FCC. So, you know, be aware of that. You might need to buy someone a new radio to improve the coverage. You might have to make adjustments to your antenna, things like that.
Michael Book? Well, folks, it's time for lunch. Any more questions? We will have time in the afternoon for questions, okay?
Can we just leave our stuff here?
I don't know.
Do we convene? 1:30?
I think it's 1:15.
Well, we have this room all day, right?
Yes, but could people wander in and walk off on our stuff?
Yeah.